Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us in this endeavor or want other information about the program or Jim Andrews, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Visit our archives there and listen to any program you may have missed. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. We will repeat this info at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. Our email address is jimandrews@thefinalwordradio.com. And now, Jim Andrews.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. We continue our exposition of the book of Acts. We're in Acts chapter 15. We've been looking at the narratives concerning the Jerusalem Council, where the church faced its first great theological crisis. There were those who had infiltrated the Jerusalem church and were pushing out to the Gentile churches, namely the church in Antioch, where the issue really came to a head, insisting a sect of the Pharisees who had believed, that is, believed in Jesus as the Messiah, nevertheless, they had corrupted the gospel. They were saying that it was necessary to circumcise the Gentiles and to direct them to observe the law of Moses. The church in Jerusalem settled that and reaffirmed that the gospel for Jews and Gentiles alike is by God's grace based upon faith in Christ alone. They did lay down some stipulations that Gentiles ought to observe, not in order to be saved, but in order not to cause offense, unnecessary offense to Jewish people, because they were in all these towns wherever they went, these cities, and they did not want to create unnecessary backlash. So they wrote them that they abstain from things contaminated by idols and from fornication and from what is strangled from blood. All of these things had associations with idolatry, though fornication was offensive for all people for all time in the sight of God. But again, they were not to abstain from these things in order to be saved. These were not good works to be achieved in order to commend themselves to God, but simply things to maintain not only freedom from contamination to idols, but moral contamination before the Lord, and creating offense to the Jewish people. So they go back to Antioch, and they carry the decree of the Jerusalem Council and send two representatives, Judas and Silas, back with them to confirm orally what had also been written. Now we come to verse 36. And after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, we're in chapter 15, let us return and visit the brethren in every city in which we've proclaimed the word of God. In other words, he's proposing a second missionary journey. Let's go back and see how they are. Well, Barnabas was desirous of taking John, called Mark, one who will later become the author of the Gospel of Mark. But Paul kept insisting that they should not take John, because John had deserted them in Pamphylia on their first missionary journey. He had not finished his course, but suddenly left them. He had not gone with them to the work. Now, feelings were very strong on both sides in this controversy. We read in verse 39 that there arose such a sharp disagreement that Barnabas and Saul separated from one another, Barnabas insisting on taking Mark. So Barnabas took Mark with him, and he sailed away to Cyprus. Paul chose Silas, and they departed. They were, we read, committed by the brethren to the grace of God. And he was traveling through Syria and Cilicia, the province of Cilicia, strengthening the churches. Cilicia was Paul's home base. Well, in verse 36, Paul was prompted by the Spirit, we can assume. He gets the urge to revisit the churches in all the cities to whom they, on their first missionary journey, proclaimed the gospel. He just wanted to go back, very natural, for a checkup on their spiritual well-being. We see here they hit a bump in the road, one of those very human bumps. Barnabas, who happened to be the cousin of John Mark, we learned that elsewhere. Barnabas was adamant about taking John Mark with them on this second tour of missionary duty. Barnabas was always an encourager. He was always impatient with people. He had been just the right man to introduce Paul to the saints in Jerusalem the first time Paul went there after his conversion. Paul, of course, had a different personality. Not that he wasn't an encourager, but he was a very intense man. So having been burned on their first missionary journey when Mark, for some unspecified reason, bailed out, he had deserted them, he had not gone with them to the work while they were just into their first missionary journey in Asia Minor, Paul was not agreeable to a return engagement with Mark. He just didn't have confidence in him as a to-be-relied-on associate. Now, we do not know why Mark pulled up stakes and abandoned Paul and Barnabas just after they arrived in the district of Pamphylia on that first missionary effort. All we know for sure is, whatever his reasons, Paul personally so disapproved of Mark's desertion of them at that time that he felt very strongly that for whatever reasons, he did not want to trust Mark again in that situation and to have to go through the same disappointing deal all over again. I can understand that. Paul did not think it prudent to depend on, to quote A.T. Robertson, a quitter again. That's the way Mark looked to Paul at this time. Now Barnabas, perhaps partly because he had an emotional attachment to John Mark as his blood relative, specifically a cousin, and also because he was by nature, as I mentioned, an optimistic encourager, the kind more likely to believe the best than to expect the worst in people. Well, Barnabas was just insistent on giving Mark another turn at bat. Paul, and I can really relate to him, he was a type A personality. He didn't have a lot of patience for pansies at crunch time, and he was a whole lot less patient with Mark's failure on the first journey. So consequently, the two held their ground. Paul was adamant that Mark should not accompany them on the second missionary tour. Barnabas was probably just as adamant as he should. So in verses 38 through 39, we see that Paul kept insisting that they should not take him along. The disagreement between them was so sharp that they eventually decided, you go your way and I'll go my way. So Barnabas took Mark with him, sailed away to Cyprus. That was Barnabas' home ground, and that had been their first stop on their first missionary journey. Now, as I said, Barnabas was apparently equally determined that Mark should go. You will notice one thing that's a little subtle, I think. It says that Barnabas took Mark as his partner and sailed away to Cyprus, the home island of Barnabas. Nothing is said, you will note, about Barnabas taking his leave for Cyprus with the blessing of the church at Antioch. It is said that Paul and Silas, when they took their leave, left with the church's blessing. Now, that's what we call an argument from silence. You've always got to be careful about those. But lack of any mention of this, especially since it's mentioned in the case of Paul and Silas, suggests to me at least that Barnabas and Mark left suddenly, knowing that in this instance, the sympathies of the Antioch church in this dispute were with Paul. Now, the text does not say that. It's an implication, I think, in the text. And this may have been because Barnabas lost a little respect in the eyes of this congregation when he and Peter briefly withdrew from Gentile believers, when under peer pressure from some Jews from Jerusalem, they reverted to Jewish scruples. Now, you heard me say it may have been. I don't know that. But we encounter that in Paul's epistle to the Galatians. So we can safely presume that Barnabas and Mark followed up on those who had come to Christ when he and Paul visited that island, Cyprus, on their first missionary journey. So Paul is joined by Silas, as his new partner. Silas, we take it, had returned to Jerusalem. And then, after some period, remember the narratives are compressed, after some period he wanted to come back to Antioch. They, as we see in the next chapter, took the northern route, and they visited the church they had founded in Asia Minor. So at verse 41, he was traveling through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches, referring to Paul. So Paul and Silas followed the original plan, to revisit the churches that had been established on the first missionary journey. However, it was accomplished in a different configuration than Paul had originally envisioned, since he had planned initially to go with Barnabas. So this time, Paul did not start by way of sea, but he traveled north through Syria, and from there into Cilicia, his own home province, where Tarsus was located. Now, before we leave this chapter, there are several highlights that we can glean from this narrative about the rupture between Paul and Barnabas. Here's number one. In human relations, even among the best of people with the best intentions, frictions, folks, are not uncommon. Such is the liability of our fallen condition. Even when we mean well, we are not always wise enough to do well. None of us. Many times we are unable to see things from another person's point of view. Many times we do not understand their legitimate interest as fully as we need to in order to work together smoothly and harmoniously. Probably you could not find any two men superior in their Christian characters and in their selfless devotion to Christ as these two, Paul and Barnabas. Now, that tells us something. Yet, in their personalities, they were quite different. And given the right set of circumstances, personalities so different can butt heads. In this case, they did butt heads over whether to include or exclude John Mark, who later wrote the Gospel of Mark. At this point in time, Barnabas and Saul entertain very different appraisals of the medal of Mark and Mark's fitness for their mission. The conflict in point of view differed so much that they apparently came to a mutual conclusion that it would be best if they went their separate ways. Listen, this friction and then the fracture that followed does not mean that either man was a turkey. It only meant that in human relationships, even among devout Christians, we are all broken enough that frictions go along with the human territory. Barnabas' emotions were probably running higher than his objectivity, probably because Mark was his cousin, blood's involved. Paul's opinion of Mark, on the other hand, may have been too severe, turned out to be so. Probably both men shared the blame for this breach. But as a matter of fact, they were probably both right, in a weird kind of way. Barnabas saw something in his cousin Mark that Paul couldn't see, and Barnabas turned out to be right, because Mark was the author of the Gospel of Mark. On the other hand, at this point in time, Mark may not have been ready for the rigors that Paul would face, and proved that when he bailed on his first missionary journey. Mark had some maturing to do, and to go with Paul, you needed some maturity, that's for sure. Number two, talking about several highlights that we can glean from this narrative about the rupture between Paul and Barnabas. As others have pointed out, the Spirit of God used the severity of Paul and the mercy of Barnabas to bring Mark to a point of usefulness. There's a good chance that when Mark set out on his first tour with Paul and Barnabas, he may have shown the effects of a soft upbringing, and he was not yet up to enduring hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. It is possible that when things got dicey, or Mark got homesick, or whatever happened, he deserted the team and headed home for those reasons. We just don't know for sure what his motive was, but whatever it was, it certainly didn't set well with Paul, who felt Mark had just bailed on them at a bad time, and was therefore untrustworthy and an unfit companion for them the next time around. He just felt he couldn't be relied on. How did this help Mark? Well, as another commentator has noted, Mark may have been deeply humbled by the rigor and the soldierly toughness of Paul, but God balanced that with the indulgent love of Barnabas. Says Rigger, the one was as necessary to him as the other, Paul and Barnabas, he means. Barnabas occupied the position of a kind and gentle mother, who is very willing to excuse and overlook the faults of her children. Paul acts like a thoughtful father, who applies the rod and says, the spoiled child must be taught to feel, says Gossner. The good news of this breach is that at the end of the day, Mark pans out. In Colossians chapter 4, verse 10, when the Apostle Paul was languishing in a Roman prison, guess who was there with him, ministering to him? Of all people, Mark. And in Paul's first epistle to the Corinthians, written about 7 years later, Paul cites Barnabas as himself as servants of God in a certain situation, without any hint of remaining hard feeling. So though Barnabas hereafter disappears from Luke's narrative in Paul's missionary journeys, it seems the heat generated by the issue over Mark was quickly put behind both of them. A third thing that we should note in this dispute between Paul and Barnabas. Once again, we see that though God does not precipitate conflicts, here we're talking about a human personality conflict, he does know how to orchestrate them for good. Mark was salvaged by Barnabas, and eventually, as we noted earlier, became a good servant to Paul. And the two men accomplished more than they might have had they gone together. One team became two. Both had more time to devote to their spheres than they might have had they gone together. Another illustration, man does his thing, but God does his. Mark, as we mentioned, came fully around to the man he ought to be, and in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 11, at a time when Paul was in prison the second time, he asked Timothy, quote, to pick up Mark and to bring him with you, for he is useful to me for service. Now that's a high compliment from a soldierly spirit like Paul, a man who had little patience with wimps who couldn't take the heat. That compliment also reveals a man, meaning Paul, who is capable of changing his opinion of a person when circumstances warrant. He did not let pride blind his objectivity. When Mark changed, and he needed to, Paul embraced him fully. A fourth note that we should make regarding this dispute is this. Just because issues make it expedient for us to work separately, I'm talking about Christian brothers, it does not mean that we cannot work together for the greater good of Christ. That's a paradox, not a contradiction. My wife and I, in nearly all things, work well together. Even hanging wallpaper, back when that was an in thing, it no longer is, we got along pretty good at that. I think I've probably hung somewhere between 180 and 200 rolls of that stuff. One venue, however, where we do not work well together is in the kitchen. In part, that is due to the somewhat cramped space around the work centers. But more of the problem has to do with our kitchen priorities. My wife cares a lot less, and she will tell you so. She cares a lot less about the food than about the mess. I care a lot less about the temporary mess than the food, though both of us hate messes. She's always trying to keep things cleaned up, washed up, and put up, while I'm trying to get it out and mix up things. We're always bumping into each other. We just don't rhyme well in a kitchen. I love her, she loves me, and both of us have the same ultimate purpose in mind, preparing a good, enjoyable meal for ourselves or our guest, and eating it in a clean and uncluttered environment. But again, we're different personalities, so we have different ways of getting there and different priorities in the process. We both desire the same outcome. We just don't mesh well in the kitchen. So we often have conflict when circumstances require us to use the kitchen at the same time. If possible, the process will be more friction-free if I manage to do my thing and then she comes along and does her thing. For all of our compatibility, and it is amazing across the board, There's another way Aussie and I differ. For those in our church who know both of us, actually, of the two of us, she's the most adventurous, though you would never guess that. And that trait is, in part, keyed to her native optimism, her belief that nothing will go wrong, that the obvious dangers will not come to pass. Like the man Winston Churchill once described, who related as he neared death, that, quote, "My whole life was burdened by great troubles, most of which never happened." I'm a risk taker, but only when I have solid reasons for believing in a good outcome. One time way back in the mid-70s, a certain startup airline was offering ridiculous fares to London. Aussie, who I learned, to my surprise, much later in life, loves to travel. She got it in her head that it would be a great idea for the two of us and our two girls just to head out for England and Europe for a time, see the country at a price we, under those circumstances, could honestly afford. But me, I like a plan. I really like a plan, especially when I'm going where I don't know the turf or don't know the language or the customs. I wanted to know what the itinerary was. I wanted to know where we were going to stay, and I wanted to know how we were going to get around and find our way. Her answer, "Jimmy, we'll figure all that out when we get there." Not me. Having a daily headache worrying about finding a suitable place to stay in towns and villages I knew nothing about, especially bringing along two young girls, that was not going to be a dream for me, but a nightmare. Well, the whole idea crashed on that rock, and the money we saved, we used to build a new home. Good thing, because the airline we were planning on to get us over there and back went defunct in the time frame we would have been there, leaving a host of people, including us, out of their fare money and stranded in Heathrow Airport in London. In that way, Aussie needed to go with her type and let me go with my type. We might all get to Europe and enjoy the ride, but each of us in his or her own way. It's not a matter of character. It's a matter of personality. Sometimes it's just a matter of different outlooks or perceptions of reality. I can't work closely in tandem with someone who is messy, disorganized, flies by the seat of their pants. My wife is certainly not messy or disorganized by any stretch. But in things like that, she's adventurous, but she would fly by the seat of her pants. I think that is one reason the Spirit of God has seen fit to allow the mission of our Lord Jesus Christ to be advanced in this world under so many denominational flags. You will notice that charismatic and Pentecostal Christians tend to be different than, let's say, evangelical Baptists, who tend to be noticeably different in their personalities than, say, evangelical Presbyterians, who also worship and work quite differently than, say, evangelical Lutherans, Episcopalians, and Anglicans. If some of us lived 300 years, we would never find a comfort zone in rigidly formal liturgical settings. Never. It would be an absolute straitjacket that would suffocate us. At the opposite end of the spectrum, it would be difficult for some of us to be comfortable in a highly emotional, charismatic, or Pentecostal setting, where feelings are king and thought and order takes a back seat. Those to whom those extremes appeal would never be very comfortable with us either. The charismatic Pentecostal group would think we are not emotional enough, and the other pole, the Lutheran Episcopalian type, would see us as too informal and aesthetically sterile for their taste. And that's just the way it is, and we need to be comfortable with that. Finally, I would just point out this breach that God used for good cannot be used, as one has said, for Christian quarreling. That's not a legitimate option. Well, thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word, remember, is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us in this endeavor or want other information about this program or Jim Andrews, please visit our website at www.thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is jimandrews@thefinalwordradio.com. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this broadcast outreach.